It's Monday. It's slightly overcast. I'm Gab. He's Jules. It's the Gab and Jules show. We have a huge show. Mega quick hits, but there's one place to start, which is the most exciting title race in Europe. Sorry, Liga.
It's fine.
It is in La Liga. And when the dust has settled from the weekend, we have Atletico Madrid after the 0-0 draw with Barcelona. 2 points clear of Barca and Real Madrid.
Yeah.
Real Madrid themselves drawing 2-2 with Sevilla, who are fourth, thanks to a last-ditch deflected goal from Toni Kroos. So who better to unpack this with than Sid Lowe? Sid, let's get right into it. Real Madrid, I thought Sevilla played them off the park in the first half, playing without a recognized striker. Was this a hangover? And is this another example of kind of that Real Madrid never say die until the end quality, that, or just sheer dumb luck that they get the equalizer in such a mad way? Because Kroos' shot was definitely going out, I thought.
You know, in that first half, watching Sevilla, it kind of brought to mind some of those performances from Barcelona under Pep Guardiola, where Sevilla just had the ball, just moved it and moved it and moved it and kept moving it. And it was, the degree of control was really quite something. And watching up close, because I was at Valdebebas as well, was very, very striking. The ease with which Sevilla seemed to be able to control the game. It's true that they didn't create a huge amount of chances, but they were much, much the better side. Although Madrid did react. In terms of your kind of question about, is this Real Madrid always finding a way through? Last night, the fact that they didn't win made me think, well, you know, this time they didn't find a way through. But actually, if you look at the table and the way it is now, that 93rd minute goal from Toni Kroos or Eden Hazard, depending on who you're giving it to, actually could be huge, because it keeps Real Madrid above Barcelona. And it also puts Real Madrid in a position now going into the final three games that, yes, the league title is in Atletico Madrid's hands. But if Atletico Madrid do so much as draw now, it goes back into Real Madrid's hands. And obviously, without that goal, they would have needed Atletico Madrid to lose one of those three games, not just to draw it.
There you go. He does maths too. Now, speaking of Atletico, that game against Barcelona on Saturday, George, I thought this was a missed opportunity for Barcelona. Not necessarily because they played better, but because I just thought, because of what Sid said as well, they had to win.
They had to win, really, where you could argue that, and we mentioned with Sid about it on Friday night on the FC show, that you could see what Atletico could go for in the draw, although I thought they played really well in the first half, created some chances. I was just very disappointed by what Barca did. I mean, Messi could have almost scored the goal of the season, but didn't in the end. But there was not enough creativity, I thought, just not enough clear-cut chances. And for a game that you had to win so close to the end of the season, where winning La Liga, you know, was like a long dream a few months ago, and you don't do enough, you don't go for it. I don't know, I thought he was very disappointed.
You on board with that, Sid?
Well, yeah, I am. But I think you can look beyond even just this game. I think if you look at their defeat against Granada, not last Thursday, the Thursday before, and at that point, that was the point at which they could have put themselves in a position in which the league was entirely in their own hands. And they didn't take it. They were 1-0 up and they got beaten. And you're right, going into this game, I thought Atletico Madrid... Actually, there's a certain parallel between the Sevilla-Real Madrid game and the Atletico Madrid-Barcelona game, in that the supposedly less big of the two teams involved is a side that dominates the first half in both cases, maybe even a little bit more than the first half in Atletico Madrid's case. There was a reaction from Barcelona, but there was a really significant lack of, I don't know if it's urgency or character or an awareness that the league was slipping away and they absolutely had to win. They would argue, of course, that they had a very good chance later on for Dembele and he probably should have scored it. They will argue that they did carry the game to Atletico a little bit. But I think it's a recurring theme. If you look at the results against the other two teams in the title race, if we're ruling out Sevilla here, which I think we have to, Barcelona in the potentially 12 points against Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid have picked up one. And that's been, in a way, the story of the season. There has been something that has just fallen short, whether that's character, whether it's a little bit of quality, whether it's something extra. And each time you could look at particular moments of the game and say they were unfortunate, but it just hasn't happened. And I think that's the feeling, that if Barcelona aren't in this title race, having been given the opportunity to get back into it, it's because they're probably just not quite good enough when it comes to the games that are big.
Sid, we haven't had you on the show since the Super League was launched and then later aborted. Can you give us a sense of, I think this is a question some people might be asking, because we've had an overwhelming reaction from supporters here in England where we live. In Italy, it's been more mixed. In Spain, it's kind of a different animal because, you know, they wheel out those statistics where like 2/3 of the population follow Barcelona and Real Madrid. I have no idea if that's actually true or how they measure that. But can you tell us what the reaction has been over there, and perhaps explain a little bit why there's a lot of people who are maybe saying, oh yeah, Real Madrid, like Barcelona and Juventus, are doing the right thing in standing tall and not giving in to those bullies in neon.
Well, I mean, that the idea of UEFA bullying and UEFA's overbearing power has been a very significant one in the whole kind of narrative around this in Spain, and in particular has been a very significant one since the collapse of the Super League, and the sense that Seferin has been vengeful. The idea, kind of a conspiratorial idea here, that he's now got it in for Real Madrid in particular, and obviously by extension, up to a point for Barcelona, and of course, indeed, Juventus. I think one of the reasons why the reaction to it here was different to England, and you're absolutely right, that it was much more lukewarm. There wasn't a kind of an outright rejection of it. I think some fans were definitely opposed to it. Some fans even spoke out, but there wasn't the kind of protest that we saw in England. I think the same is true of the media, although there were some people who were critical of it. I think you have to start looking at it from the point of view of footballing cultures and cultures of fandom. And cultures of fandom in Spain are very different. And in particular, the dominance of Real Madrid and Barcelona. And I think what that means is that there is an internalized idea, perhaps, that the rest of the league isn't worthy of Real Madrid and Barcelona. An internalized idea that the, if you like, the concept of them going it alone to look for a better league is kind of seen as okay. Now, there's no sense of, well, why, you know, there's no kind of, if you like, rejection of the idea that you would ditch the other 18 clubs or the other 17, because, of course, Atletico were on board as well. I think there isn't a kind of a natural feel for the smaller clubs in Spain as there isn't in England, for example. And all of that feeds in to an idea, which, of course, is all represented in the media as well, which is very much dominated by Real Madrid and, to a slightly lesser extent, Barcelona. Those two clubs, I can't stress this enough, are huge compared to everyone in Spain on every level, on a social level, on a media level, an economic level. And I think that conditions the way in which people reacted to this.
There's so much going on here. We're going to get into it more on the Gavin Jules podcast. So stick with us. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Hey, Sid, that's certainly the impression I get in terms of the reaction, and also the fact that Florentino has been talking about this on and off for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. So maybe people were prepared. But I wanted to ask two things of you. In fact, I'll take them separately so as not to confuse things. One is, I feel like Florentino's been the only guy to really go out and talk. We've heard very, very little from Barcelona. And I find that interesting, too, because we lump them together because they elect presidents or whatever. But Real Madrid have a statue, which basically, because of the number of years that you must have been a member, because of the number of years you must have been on the board to be eligible to be president, because of the fact that you have to go and provide a bank guarantee for, I think, this is 20-25% of the club's budget. Essentially, the Venn diagram of people who can be elected president of Real Madrid is, as the joke goes, is just one person. Barcelona, very, very different. Barcelona also really pushed this, like, you know, more than a club, ethos, whether it's real or just commercial or not, they give off a far more lefty vibe, I think most people would agree, than Real Madrid. Are you surprised that we haven't heard Laporta or anybody else take a view on this, other than this joint statement that they issued and what Laporta said on Sunday night? Is it just a case that he wants to see which way the wind blows before he takes a position?
Yeah, and I'm surprised on lots of different levels. One of them is that Laporta himself had suggested that he wasn't particularly keen on the Super League idea publicly, as he was standing as a candidate. He had said, in fairness to him, that they would look at every possible, if you like, avenue of increasing income, that he wasn't necessarily opposed to the idea of a Super League in general, but that he didn't like the Super League ideas that he'd heard about. In other words, the idea of a close, essentially what was eventually presented. That's one reason to be surprised. The other, as you say, is that it fits a little bit uneasily with that idea of kind of Mezquite Club and so on, which is obviously a very nebulous idea, but it is, broadly speaking, as you say, a socially inclusive vibe, or a lefty vibe, if you like. There's a broad idea of that. And then the other reason, I think, is that even if you were to take on board the financial situation of Barcelona, and never, ever, ever overlook that, because that is what's dictating everything here, and Laporta has only been president for, 3 months now, and he's come in and he's encountering a situation even worse than he imagined, and they're desperate. That's the context of this. They are desperate. But even if you take all that on board, even if you think to yourself, the Super League is a great idea for Barcelona, and Barcelona are absolutely right to go into it, there is still that awkwardness in which, at the moment, it appears like Barcelona are allowing themselves to be portrayed, whether it's true or not is another issue, as the club that's just being led by Florentino, that's allowing the president of Real Madrid to call the shots, the president of Real Madrid to be the figurehead of this, and for them to be the ones kind of following in its wake. Now, up to a point, that will probably be considered unfair to say that, but that is the public impression being given. Like, to give you a really clear example of this, when Florentino Perez went on El Chiringuito, he said Barcelona will speak tomorrow. We didn't hear anything from Barcelona. Florentino has spoken on behalf of Barcelona more than Barcelona have spoken on behalf of Barcelona. And I think that projects a weakness. And not just a weakness, not just because it's Real Madrid, although I think that's pretty embarrassing for Barcelona, to be honest. But I think it projects a weakness that, okay, if, as per your statement, you truly believe in this project, is that if, as per your statement, you believe that this is necessary, not just a good idea, but necessary for you, come out and say so. Say so. Explain it. Make it your voice. And I think there is something very, very difficult, particularly for a president as charismatic as Laporta is. If this had happened with Bartomeu, it might have fit the character a little bit more. But a guy that's as charismatic, as pugnacious, as kind of enjoys winding people up as much as Laporta does, and actually, I think in part, and this is a slight aside, but let's throw this in here, I think his charisma has been offered up in lieu of content, because there's been no content at all, almost, in what he's done so far. But for him to kind of almost be seen as the person being led by the hand by Florentino Perez, I think it's a really difficult position for Barcelona to find themselves in.
All right, my final point on this is just more generally about La Liga, and then we will go back to the actual football on the pitch, as I know is what Jules wants to talk about. It's what I want to talk about too. But so I live here in England, as you know, and we watch this thing called La Liga TV, which is paid for by the Spanish League and pushed by your mate Javier Tebas, who basically, they go out of their way. Obviously, they talk more about the teams near the top of the league, but they go out of their way to give everybody space and kind of push this idea, and runs contrary, I think, to the way the media works in Spain, where obviously anybody who's been there on holiday knows where the focus is. Mm. Somebody gave me some numbers that kind of debunked one of Florentino's messages, which is like, the sky is falling, people are losing interest in football, ratings are down, blah, 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 Fortnite, we need 45-minute games, whatever else, right? Which is, it's all back-of-the-envelope stuff. He didn't provide any data for any of this. But one of the things that was pointed out to me was that, yes, it's true, overall ratings and viewership have fallen for La Liga, but they've actually proportionally fallen far more for the big clubs. In other words, the Elches, the Valladolids, or even the mid-table clubs, they haven't really suffered a decline in viewership. So in other words, very few people were viewing them relative to Real Madrid and Barcelona, but those guys are still there.
Yeah.
The people who've taken a big hit are actually the bigger clubs proportionally. And I thought this is a really interesting part of the conversation, because I do wonder, do you get a sense in Spain that people are less interested in watching football, but is it mainly maybe perhaps the more casual fans who maybe came to it later, and maybe they're less interested now?
Well, look, I must admit, I have doubts about all of these kind of grand statements at all sorts of levels about how football is collapsing and how we need to change it for the new generations and so on. I think the way that people engage with football may well be changing, and I would love to see statistics that are convincing, because frankly, the statistics that Agnelli has talked about are not entirely convincing. But if you're asking me, which you are, I believe, specifically about how it feels within Spain rather than globally, and I think that's the question here. We're talking about, is there a global shift or is there a within Spain shift? And they're two very different things in terms of the health of the game. I think within Spain, I think we are seeing a shift over the last year because people aren't inside stadiums, and that makes the whole thing feel different. I don't think, but obviously, look, I say this from my position, and my position is obviously an unusual one because I work in this. You know, I am focused on this. I am watching this because I need to, as well as because I love football. I don't have a sense within Spain that this is a declining product. I don't have a sense within Spain that nobody cares about Elche or Valladolid in a way that wasn't the case before. They are minor considerations compared to Madrid and Barcelona, but they always were. I don't have a sense that people are switching off. I just don't think that's true, except, of course, in the context of people not going to games, which removes not just the fact of being at games, but that sense that this is kind of, you know, a big event. Because in a way, and this is obviously one of the conundrums that TV companies have, they don't really care if people are in the stadiums because they want people sitting at home watching it. But actually, they do care, because a big part of the product is that idea that you're sitting in a stadium, that you're sharing in an event in which people are part of it. And you think about some of the things that have happened in this extraordinary La Liga title race, and you think, oh, imagine these moments with fans, you know, imagine the delirium in the stadiums and so on. And so, look, I mean, in answer to your question, has this collapsed within Spain? I think the answer is no. I think it hasn't.
Right. Well, look, you contradict Florentino at your peril. Let's get back to the actual football, because we have legit excitement, as we said earlier. I want to kind of take this in turns. Jules, you were very impressed, I think. Well, we both were. We've been impressed with the job Lopetegui's done all season. I really wanted to dislike Lopetegui, partly because of the awful Judas Benedict Arnold move that he pulled at the World Cup, which cost Spain a World Cup. But I got to say, he's been tremendous.
He's been great
this season.
He's been
great. Got it right. He got it right
with Papu.
With that, yeah, and then Chuck Enesiri on in the second half and see what happened.
And just, he was in the stands, and you can just imagine what he was thinking. If he could prevent Real Madrid from winning La Liga title, what a great, sweet revenge it would be after what happened when they sacked
exactly.
him 2 days, not 2 days, but you know, so soon after he took over the job, after that disaster of the 2018 World Cup and all of that. And you could almost see in his eyes as he was talking on the phone to the staff on the bench. And I just thought they were brilliant. There's one thing I didn't understand from Real Madrid point of view, and we were quite critical of them after the Chelsea second leg, but they score a goal that gets disallowed, the Benzema header for a couple of toes from Odriozola, which he's offside, no problem.
Yep.
But this comes from a move on the right-hand side. And then, for pretty much the rest of the game, they attack on the left-hand side with Marcelo, which again, I'm sorry for the viewers and listeners who love Marcelo, but as I always say, he should not be playing, not just for Real Madrid, but football anymore at all anyway. But then, why do you keep attacking on the left-hand side with Vinicius and Marcelo, where it's clearly not working, where Sevilla are good defending there, when the right-hand side has been good for you when you scored that goal, and yet Odriozola has hardly touched the ball for the rest of a good part of an hour. And then guess what? The first Real Madrid goal comes from the right-hand side with Asensio, who scored the goal after coming on.
I would assume it had to do with the fact that Acuña, who was playing way up at the beginning, started sitting deeper. Am I wrong, Sid, or...?
But still,
or is it just
it was
that,
far too one-sided.
Or is it, as Jules says, you know, but and I take your point, and we've defended Zidane because I said he's had limited options. It does seem he's always going back to the big players, the people who've done it for him in the past. And I wonder if there isn't part of it as well, yeah, maybe Marcelo can't defend, but he can come up with something special.
There you come.
Whereas this Odriozola guy is just a kid, and he's sucked since he's been here and whatever. Is there something in that? Is there some sort of old manager loyalty to older players that maybe, and reputations that skews this a little? Because the reputations have come through to him him this season, to be fair.
There's loads of elements that you've thrown into the equation here. Let me start at the very start and try and put two of them together. And you're saying that Lopetegui got it right. I think there's one thing that possibly he got wrong. And I say this from my perspective in the stadium, which in the second half was on Marcelo's wing. And I've got Marcelo right in front of me because it's quite a small stadium because it's the training ground and you're very close to the action. And I must admit, as that second half went on, I thought one thing Lopetegui didn't do, which he could have, get someone on going at Marcelo.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he looked shot. Get someone quick going at Marcelo. Now, he had Suso closest to Marcelo for most of the game. Now, Suso is technically very, very good indeed, but he's not someone who's going to run beyond you.
No.
And when he put En-Nesyri on and took off Papu Gomez. So he takes Papu off. And I must admit, I was slightly surprised. I was thinking, well, put En-Nesyri on, but put him on the wing, going beyond Marcelo into that space. Now, obviously, as it turns out, Sevilla did catch Real Madrid a couple of times going beyond them, but actually it was Ocampos on the other side. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I'm glad you picked up on Marco Asensio, because I want to pick up on Marco Asensio as well. In a season in which, it's true, he hasn't always risen to the occasion, but in which none of the forwards have, and in which Zidane has clung to the idea of Hazard, Marco Asensio came on last night and totally changed the game.
Yeah.
Not only does he score the goal, he's the one that makes that move happen. He's the one that wins the ball, brings it back in, gets it back to Kroos, and then moves into space to get it from Kroos again and score. When you look at the goal that either Kroos or Hazard scores, depending on who you want to give it to,
or Diego Carlos.
Again, it's Asensio who goes and gets it and keeps that move alive. And there's a willingness from him. And in a team that doesn't score goals, someone who can actually shoot is not a bad idea. Mm. And you look at that forward line, and Vinicius does nice things, but he's not a finisher. We know that. And so I think that's significant as well. So you've got those two elements coming together. The other thing, as you say, is that towards the end, I think Madrid did start to make a reasonable amount happen. But if you look at it, a lot of it, I think, is still shots from around the edge of the area.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I don't think this is a team that cuts through you very often, apart from, of course, that lovely, lovely move between Kroos and Modric,
which Vinicius
somehow puts against the post. Yeah.
Well, it's not just that. Also, he had Benzema wide open behind him.
Yeah,
I'd love to know if Benzema shot. I want to get to the other game, but first, because I don't want to anger the Real Madrid fans out there. Zinedine Zidane not happy about the incident with the penalty with Eder Militao. For those who didn't see it, Eder Militao jumps for the ball. It hits his arm.
He turns his body first.
I mean, he was all like out of control. I mean, but he, and then the ball goes the other end. Benzema gets brought down for a penalty. So Real Madrid goes from thinking they have a penalty, but no, VAR, check Eder Militao. Oh, it's a penalty the other way. Mm. Does Zizou have a point, or is he just wrong? Because based on the rules and based how handball is interpreted, that is 100% a penalty.
The first thing I would say about Zidane is, for all his anger, and he said he was angry, for all the significance of this decision, because of course this could well be the league title, he managed to do it without ranting, without crying, without raving, without confronting the referees.
How often does he rant or rave? I mean, he might headbutt people occasionally, but
he never does.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean. I think I quite admire that in him. You know, the difference between him and other managers is startling in this sense. So in that sense, I think he's entitled to ask the kind of questions he asked last night, which was to talk about whether he understands the handball rules and we need this explaining to us and so on. So I think on that side of things, he's right, or at least he's entitled to say so. In terms of the actual decision, I think he's wrong. In terms of the actual decision, I think it's a handball. And I think actually there's been more of a debate around this than there really needs to be. But I can understand it, because it's a decision that could, you know, the league title is on the line here. And I think it's then easy, of course, to go back over the season and say, look, there's another handball that's similar and it wasn't given. Or this handball was and that one wasn't. And that happens all the time. And of course, everyone goes and finds the evidence that suits them. But in terms of this specific handball, I must admit, I think quite a lot more noise has been made about it than is really necessary. Right. We can debate about whether the rules themselves should change, But it's a handball.
I agree. It's a futile debate. It's been this way.
It's only because they had the Benzema counter-attack and the penalty on the other hand. Otherwise, no one moans about it.
And also, probably had to say something. And otherwise, if he hadn't said that, he would have been asked about, is Vinicius a net positive or a net negative? Because if I'm Benzema, I rip Vinicius a new one for the goal he missed. I'm sure Benzema called for it. I am 100% certain he did. And he must have, but whatever.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the other game. I'm wondering, Jules, you've been down on Barcelona and stuff, and we're all going to eat a lot of humble pie if Koeman somehow does this because of everything he's been through. In this game, though, he had more things go wrong for him with people having to come off and Elash and whatever. Do you want to give him a little bit of a pass here?
No, not in a game like this. Not in a game like this. We said it earlier. This is the game you have to win. I don't care. You need to find a way of winning this. You know, make your substitution, make your starting 11 in a way that you can go and take the game away from Atletico and you can go and score goals, even if that means you can concede. It doesn't matter. Go and win it. They were never really in a position. Okay, there's the Dembele chance at the end. But again, that chance should not fall to Dembele. Because as we've seen at the Parc des Princes in the Champions League and through the whole season, Dembele has done well up front. But he's not a striker and he's not a finisher. But you were never in a position to win a game like this, which I think is a real shame. Go for it. You could lose 1-0 on the counter goal by Suarez and you say, okay, we tried, we went for it. It didn't happen for us, but at least we've got no regrets. Now, don't tell me that none of those players have regrets after the game on Saturday. Yeah. All of them must feel like, oh, damn, we had such a big chance. And now, they're 2 points behind, but really they're 3 points behind because they've lost the head-to-head to Atleti. Because they lost the game in Madrid. So it's actually 3 points behind they are. They need 3 points more than Atleti between now and the end of the season if they want to go over them.
Said, I'm not as harsh on Koeman as Jules is, but I think Jules is right in the sense that if you do kind of a risk-benefit, and a risk-reward analysis here, and I take the Dembele chance out of it, you had a lot less to lose by going for it. You know, it's almost like whether you draw or lose this game,
it's the same.
It's not going to matter so much,
exactly.
Right? Did now, obviously, Koeman couldn't have known that Real Madrid were going to draw with Sevilla the following day. But still, I mean, were you as disappointed as I was that maybe that they didn't take more chances?
Yeah. I mean, yes, it's the short answer. I think they also had an Atletico Madrid side who I thought played very well in the first half and I thought carried the game to them. And it did seem to take a while for Barcelona to realise, and look, this is simplistic, but for Barcelona to realise, oh, hang on a minute, the league is going here. Maybe we should go and try and win it. I think they were damaged by the departure of Sergio Busquets, which is not something, I must admit, that I would have thought I would say. Early in the season, I thought Busquets was coming towards the end, but actually he's been really important for them in recent weeks, and without him, that made a difference. But it did feel like, for a lot of this game, it was only Messi.
Yeah.
And I don't want to, you know, completely give Messi a free pass. And people will say this is another big game in which Messi hasn't scored. But there were moments in this game where the only person who seemed to be going at Atletico was Messi. And I do think there is a sense of that. There is a sense that it was almost as if Barcelona were more concerned about losing than they were driven towards winning, even though a draw, as has been proven, really wasn't much use to them. And you say that they wouldn't have known that Real Madrid were going to draw the next night. No, but they would have had to assume that Real Madrid were going to win. Yeah, so in any case, in any case, they've got to be looking for a victory. And I think they did look for it by the end, but there was a lack of, you know, how often did we see Jordi Alba in attack, for example? And he's a key part of what they do. We didn't see enough of him. He has that one cross for Ronald Araujo for the goal, which is ruled out for offside. But we didn't see very much of him. We didn't see Pedri and De Jong have the kind of roles that they've had recently. So in Pedri's case, a lot of the ball around the edge of the area, a lot of the ball in advanced positions. In De Jong's case, a midfielder bursting through and into the box and getting into much more kind of attacking kind of spaces than a midfielder would normally do. We didn't really get any of that. And yeah, I would agree with you. I thought that Barcelona lacked, again, ambition. And you know, let's go back to that Granada game. That Granada game was the chance to put the league title in their own hands, and they didn't take it. Now, let's not analyse the game itself. Let's just sort of think about it from the point of view of the opportunity was there. After a season which you thought it was never going to be there, it was there, and you did not take it. And the day after, both of the Catalan dailies ran on the front pages saying unforgivable. Now, I'm not normally of a moralistic bent when it comes to the way that teams approach it, but you were given the chance, and I would agree with them. It was unforgivable.
All right.
Because it was unforgivable because it felt like it had happened in part because at some point in the game, they thought it was done. At some point in the game, there wasn't that, I don't know whether you'd call it attacking aggression or an urgency or an awareness of the significance of it. And I think we saw a little bit of that against Atletico. Although I think it's worth pointing out, by the way, that Atletico are still a good side, despite the fact that they've had these recent
wobbles. Can we move to Atletico? Although, George, you want to make a point first?
Just quickly, because Sid mentioned it earlier as well. They've been like this in all the big games, in La Liga this season, in the Champions League, against the two PSG game, but even the Juve game that they won, and now we know how bad Juve are anyway. This is it. They've been unable to win any big game this season, which I think shows you the limits of this team, and in a way the limits of Koeman, even if again he did much better once they changed the tactics and the formation.
And let's not forget Koeman inherited very much a dumpster fire when he took over, in addition to his own limits. I just want to end with a little bit of love for Atletico, because if they win this, if you compare this to their last Atleti team to win the title, I know Suarez has scored a lot of goals. I also know that he's 50 years old and cheated on his Italian exam. But I think he's kind of done it with smoke and mirrors. And sometimes we've seen what Atletico really are now. The two legs against Chelsea, there, for example, they were terrible and they've dropped stupid points along the way. But let's not forget who these people are. Marcos Llorente was a defensive midfielder who he reinvented as a kind of guy who can play eight different positions.
Yeah.
Lemar had an absolute stinker in his first season. João Félix, we gave him a pass at first, the pressure, the massive fee, doesn't contribute. Carrasco disappears to China, comes back, gets him to contribute. Lemar has contributed this season, as I said. Defensively, they're maybe not as watertight as they once were, but they still do pretty well with a bunch of guys who, you know, none of these people, apart from Savage when he was 18 years old, you know, have ever had a superstar label attached to them, and obviously Oblak. Mm. But I mean, is this worth reconsidering that man for man, this Atleti team is substantially worse, I think, than the last Atleti team to win the title? And if they do somehow win it, there's a million different reasons, but he deserves a lot of credit. The group deserves a lot of credit.
I think as well, this is one of the things that happens, of course, is that we make the judgments not on a whole season. We make the judgments on the second part of the season. And so if Atletico Madrid were to blow this league, it would be an enormous choke. Whereas actually their league campaign taken as a whole is very, very impressive. I think if they hang on, it's a huge achievement. I think if you'd put their half of the season the other way around, we'd be saying, oh, they were so unlucky. They did so well in the second half of the season. I think they've put themselves in a position possibly higher than their, what would you call it, their kind of natural level, as you say, in terms of the squad and the players. That said, also, it's been a season in which Madrid and Barcelona have been more vulnerable than previously, dropped a lot more points than previously. That we're going to see a league title winner, I think, with the fewest points we've seen for probably a decade. And that's a good thing on some levels, but it is, I think there are some people in Spain at least that see this as a league title race of mediocre sides rather than a tight title race between really good sides. And I think there's an element of truth in that. But I think you're right. I think there are elements of this where I think you can criticise Simeone, and I think in recent weeks at least, the way that he's changed the teams late in games, moved formations around, moved players out of position, I think has suggested a certain sense of kind of reaching, of desperation to kind of find a solution that doesn't always convince. But as you say, he's reinvented Marcos Llorente. He's found a really good role for Kieran Trippier. Savic is playing really, really well. He's recovered Lemar, who seemed to be a lost cause. He has used João Félix early in the season and then been prepared to not use him later on when he hasn't played well. Now, of course, you can argue whether that's his Simeone's fault and he should have got the best out of João Félix for an entire season. He's had Luis Suarez and slightly altered the way that they play to try and suit Suarez and got a lot of goals from him, even if it's true that over the last month or so Suarez is scoring fewer. And I think there's a huge amount of credit to be given to him there. That said, of course, if they don't win it, given the position they were in, there's no doubt we'll all be talking about them choking. And I think if you look at their results, they haven't choked. I think they've regressed to something a bit more normal. They haven't been beaten loads of times. They've had a couple of bad defeats, but largely it's been they've not quite won games. They've been too many draws rather than a whole load of defeats.
I go back to this. I think this team man for man, is substantially worse as a whole than the one that won the title last time, against better opposition as well. Mm. But, you know, mediocre Barcelona, mediocre Real Madrid are still Barcelona and Real Madrid.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And he's got mediocre Atletico.
They still can't play.
Beating them, which is just unbelievable.
They still can't last 90 minutes. They've done some really good things at times, and in the first half against Barcelona they did, but they just can't keep it up.
All right, time flies when you're having a good time, Sid, so we're going to have to leave it there. All right, enough Liga. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, guys.
Manchester City have to postpone their title celebrations after losing at home to Chelsea 2-1. Jules, they made 9 changes, while Thomas Tuchel made 5 changes and then moved 2 other guys around. In the grand scheme of things, this means very little, right?
Does it?
Well,
I don't know.
Apart from the 3 points that Chelsea got.
Yeah, but I asked Thomas Tuchel about, you know, could this have some sort of an impact on the final, even a little one anyways? Well, it's not a disadvantage, that's for sure. Then I asked the same question to Benjamin Mendy, and he goes, nah, it's not. It doesn't matter.
You think the City players think like, oh, you think the Chelsea players, oh, yeah, look, we beat them twice now. Because, yeah, these are really the same dudes.
No, but we'll maybe you think, okay.
Nathan Ake
maybe,
will be out there. No,
but maybe you think, okay, they don't like playing against the back five, they don't like playing against us, they don't like the way we get the ball out from the back.
They don't like playing against players who aren't as good as the players or the regulars.
What's true, though, in the 2 wins that Chelsea had against City this season, City never had their strongest team and not the team that would play in the final. I give you that. So, we see.
And City still outplayed them for most of the game.
Maybe in the first half, not in the second half. And sticking with City, maybe, Gab, the turning point of that game is the Sergio Aguero Panenka, or Panenka.
Yeah.
And then he apologized, of course.
Well, in fact, and before that, when Sterling scored, he took the worst touch of his career
ever.
As well.
Ever. It was even a finish one touch. Like, he didn't even control the ball.
There's obviously a lot going on in his head. Emotions, yeah. Panenka leaving after so many years. I just like this. I like the fact that El Kun took to social media and owned it and apologized. And you shouldn't apologize when you make a mistake, but you should apologize when you make a mistake because you do something that's a really bad decision, like the Panenka in this case. So I'm good with that. Milan beat Juve 3-0 in a relegation six-pointer. If only in a Champions League six-pointer. Jules, Juve are fifth. We're not going to see Pirlo next year, are we? Not after that performance.
Sure, I think that was an absolute disgrace. I think he was disgraced in the team he picked, the changes he made, waiting 67 minutes for Kulusevski to come on when you're already behind, when you're...
Well, he picked the wrong team.
I thought Kulusevski should have started that game.
In place of McKennie?
Probably, or... Yeah, probably I would have played Kulusevski one side and Chiesa on the other side. I don't know why McKennie play in a game like this.
Because you're ahead, so you get a draw and you're good.
No, I don't think so. I'm sorry. And then suddenly at halftime, you have to change pretty much everything. You're behind, you're not playing well. Cristiano hasn't touched the ball in Milan's box in the whole of the first half. You don't create anything, you don't do anything. And then after the game, he comes out and says, this is a good team, I can take it forward. You know, it's on me, but I can do better than that. No, you can't. This is just too big, too early for him. And maybe he will become a great manager, like Thierry Henry or Frank Lampard. But this is too big, too early. I'm sorry. This is not good enough. 3-0 at home. Yeah. You know what? Milan had lost their last 9 trips.
Yeah, they had never won at the Juventus Stadium.
Ever. And now you lose 3-0 like you were against Fiorentina. I mean, come on. It's too many. I don't even want to talk about him anymore.
Yeah, I guess it's like the first half, it was played at a bland rhythm and everything. You know, a bit of a fear, I think, from both sides.
Yeah.
Until the goal at the end, where Szczęsny, by the way, like, I know Szczęsny saved the penalty, but he also was completely responsible for the first goal.
Definitely.
So they cancel each other out. And then in the second half, Juventus just fall apart and get even worse. And I think that's the concern.
As for Milan, as we've just mentioned, Gab, they became the last Super League holdout to take UEFA's deal, leaving Juventus, Real Madrid and Barca on their own. Why did it take them so long to accept that deal?
Well, as reported, by the way, in ESPN,
yes,
by myself and
Moises
Llorente, UEFA gave the 9 clubs now, including Milan, who were the last to join, they gave them this deal, which... I don't say it's a slap on the wrist, but it's certainly not a big financial penalty where they have to commit to staying in the Champions League forever and they end up... In the end, the fine will work out, depending on where they get to something like between maybe 3 and 8 million maximum a year. So it's a good deal. They really thought that UEFA were out of line. That's why they waited. Yeah. They really thought that there's no way that UEFA can ban us and that we have all this legal precedent for it. But I think in the end, they said, I think there was also maybe a little bit of mistrust towards Real Madrid, Juventus, and Barcelona, that one of those clubs might be the one to say, hey, look, we'll take the deal, because once you get to nine, it's dissolved, right? So I think all those factors played into it. Now, we could find out as early as Tuesday, or maybe even later today as we record this on Monday, whether the Champions League final will be moved from Istanbul to England or possibly Portugal in light of COVID and the fact that there are two English sides in the final. Jules, where do you stand on this?
I love Istanbul. I love Turkish people, everything you want. But this is not practical. Turkey is on the red list in the UK, so you can't travel there.
You might say they're on the red list because the British government decided to put them on the red
list. Yeah, but it's on the red list. So fans could not travel, even for the teams and for the clubs. It would not be easy or practical. I think it makes a lot of sense. And Istanbul can have another final, the next one, and you can move all them down if you want or whatever. But why would you have the final over there if no fans can travel and when you can have even more fans here at Wembley from the two English teams?
I think this is the thing that got really, really politicized, right? Look, I don't have a problem with them if they deem that it should be moved here. There's going to be 4,000 fans from either club.
Yeah.
And they're going to go into a lottery and whatnot to get to the final. Yeah. So I know this whole thing, well, it was the English, you know, and you read in the English papers, right? Well, it was the English fans who stopped the Super League, so now UEFA owe us. Chelsea and Manchester City are global clubs. They have fans from all over the world, as they keep telling us, right?
Yeah.
So there would have still been 4,000 Chelsea fans and 4,000 City fans in Istanbul regardless. You know, the red list doesn't mean that you cannot travel.
No.
It just simply means that you have to quarantine. It would have been much harder for those 4,000, but it's already going to be very hard for those fans to get in. I don't like the way this thing has been politicized from a public health perspective. Sure, fine. Let's go ahead and do this. But it kind of bugs me when politicians drop in and kind of try to make hay with this.
Bloomberg are reporting that UEFA are planning to generate more money for clubs via a €6 billion deal with Centricus, which sounds like a Marvel villain, as you rightly put
it. Might be.
Yeah. I assume it's not, though.
It's not actually Marvel, as far as we know. So Centricus came up when there was talk of the FIFA Club World Cup and SoftBank and all this stuff. Essentially, what it is they collect money from investors, and effectively what they do is they tell UEFA, here, UEFA, we'll give you some money up front, and then you'll pay us back over time out of Champions League revenues as these revenues grow. I'm not sure I like the deal. I appreciate you need some immediate cash to deal with anything, but the only way they should make this is if at the same time they have serious cost control, they have serious financial fair play enforcement, and it's not just kind of like a shill to make the clubs happy. Yeah. That's my main concern here. Manchester United beat Aston Villa 3-1 as your boy Paul Pogba gets criticized by Dean Smith for going down too easily for penalty. You'll stick up for Paul,
come
right?
On, please, come on. What? You lost. You're angry that you lost. Don't take it on Paul. It was a penalty 100%. He went. Douglas Luiz went through him. What's this about?
Stop it, Dean. We love you, but stop.
Yeah. West Ham lost to Carlo Ancelotti's Everton, and David Moyes questioned the integrity of United's scheduling, or rescheduling, if you want. They play Leicester on Tuesday and then Liverpool on Thursday. Gab, does he have a point?
He completely has a point.
But like, where do you want to play that Liverpool?
But equally,
game?
There's no alternative.
Exactly.
He has a point because if you're United, you've got the Europa League coming up, you've got nothing to play for. I think Solskjaer would be silly not to go and play the scrubs in both these games. And obviously, West Ham are competing with Liverpool and Leicester for a place in the top four. Simple as that. Equally, you'd have a stronger point if they'd beaten Everton. But he's right. But there's no alternative. You know, and I feel for David. I really do. Liverpool beats Southampton 2-0 as Thiago Alcantara scores his first goal for the club. Jules, this was a long time coming.
Thiago Alcantara. Yeah, long time coming. I mean, I felt for him because, he hasn't always been great, but I don't think all the issues were just down to him and the way he plays and whether that suits or not the team. Yeah. But, he scored a good goal. It's an important goal. They had to win this game. It was not perfect. Far from it, that performance. But they can still have that little hope to make it to the top four. So, well done. Bayern are crowned champions before even getting onto the pitch, but that doesn't stop them from hammering Borussia Mönchengladbach 6-0 on Saturday evening with a hat-trick from Robert Lewandowski. Gab, he needs just one goal now. he's on 39 to equal Gerd Müller's record from 71-72 of 40 goals in a season.
Phenomenal achievement. There's zero doubt in my mind that had it not been for his injury, he would have already had it. Let's not forget, he missed four, five games, I think, actually, in total, that he missed through his injury. So, yeah, Gerd Müller's a legend, but Lewandowski will be remembered as a legend, too.
Coming.
Lille beat Lens on Friday, and Paris Saint-Germain can't go beyond a draw with Rennes, which means they're 3 points back with two games to go. Jules, do you still believe?
No, I don't. I don't. Even a miracle would not save us. It was not a good performance against Rennes. No Mbappé, no Verratti. And as you said, Lille won, so they've got... I think they need to lose one of the last two games they played against Saint-Étienne and Angers. It's not going to happen.
I think we need to show some love, too, for Rennes, Italian goalkeeper, part of a goalkeeping dynasty.
Please.
Four brothers, all goalkeepers.
Yes.
Thank you, Alfred Gomis.
Neymar signs a new four-year extension with PSG, which means that he's staying until 2025 with an extra year as an option as well to 2026. Gab, since you're always talking about money for players over 30, he turns 30 in February. So it's not a good deal, right?
I feel slightly different about Neymar. Because it's Neymar, because it gives you the option to hang on to Mbappe a little bit longer.
Probably.
Possibly. I think this came into it as well. Look, Paris Saint-Germain have perfected the art of... They're like those NBA teams that have like two superstars who they pay everybody. And then they kind of fill out the rest with journeymen and like one or two role players here and there. It works for them. I mean... I don't know. And they're used to him being unavailable anyway, so why not?
But Poch said we'll have big decisions to make in the summer.
Yeah, hey. He'll have big decisions to make.
Yeah.
Tottenham lose to Leeds United 3-1. They're no closer to appointing a new manager, and the Harry Kane rumors won't go away. There's a really bad vibe around this club.
There is, Gab. I mean, it was a terrible performance to start with against Leeds. Just nothing happening in the game. And I know Kane got a goal disallowed for a toe again, but they were still not enough, not good enough. And I can see why the rumors are not going away, Gabby. It's a worrying time.
They have to keep believing. They become much more appealing if they're in Europa League. They can still control it. Make it happen.
Staying in North London, Arsenal beat West Brom 3-1 as Willian, scores his first goal of the season. And Odegaard, Aubameyang, Thomas Partey, Tierney and Lacazette are all on the bench. Gab, with nothing to play for, I guess it's right for Mikel Arteta to give more game time to
Just players. Keep making more excuses for him.
A goal by Pepe, by the way.
Yeah, great goal by Pepe and stuff. I'm sorry, I just went back to the beginning. I got abuse from Arsenal fans. Like, oh, no, you need to extend Alba. No, Willian. These people, if they don't play, they're not contributing, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, in this game, you know, the horse has bolted. Sure, go ahead. Play whoever. Play Martinelli up front. Doesn't really matter. But why couldn't you structure yourself differently, save yourself some money? Chickens have come home to roost at this club. Jadon Sancho comes up big as Borussia Dortmund beat Leipzig 3-2 in a preview of Thursday's cup final. Mm. Jules, this was huge on so many levels.
It was, Gab, because Dortmund are now fourth in the table and Frankfurt only managed a draw. And then if it's all in Dortmund's hand without Erling Haaland, who was injured and in the stands, who celebrated like a madman, the Sancho goal towards the end of the game. And it was great. Well done.
Did you like the little hashtag on his thing? What you can't.
Exactly. And Edin Terzic, we've been hard on him at times because we had to be and he deserved to be. But now, if he can turn this round, well done to him.
When Leipzig got back to 2-2. I thought, this is it. Dortmund are all going to collapse like we've seen them do. But no, they didn't.
The cup final on Thursday would be amazing. Victor Osimhen scores twice as Napoli win at Spezia 4-1 to move into the Champions League spots. Gab, Napoli would wonder where they would be if he'd been around all season.
Yeah, so Victor Osimhen this season,
seven goals in four games, in the last four
it's
games.
It's something like that. It's one goal every 80 minutes. Unfortunately, obviously, he had his COVID, he had his injuries, all these things have affected him. I'm telling you, I said at the start of the season, Napoli had, I think, arguably the most talented or the second most talented squad in Serie A.
Yeah.
If they hadn't all this nonsense between the president and Gattuso, even now they're in a media blackout. And if he'd been fit, I think they would be right up there challenging Inter for the Scudetto, which frankly is completely amazing. This is the Gattuso we're talking about. Big, big tip of the hat for him. And between Osimhen and Vlahovic, two talented young strikers in Serie A. All right, we're going to go back and talk some more Lille to show him some love. But I just want to reiterate the point that Serie A has historically been the league for very old strikers.
Yeah.
Let me just repeat this again. Vlahovic, Osimhen, I feel really, really good about those two. And they're not the only ones.
I don't know how long Vlahovic will stay in Serie A.
60 maybe, million euros they want.
Maybe not long. Osimhen, though, you have him for a few times. But I think Napoli can have a lot of regrets on how this season, what could have happened this season.
Yeah. Can we recommend our friend Paulo Fonseca for Napoli? Or they won't
go there. Love that. Yeah. I would love that a lot.
But anyway, let's show Leo some more love, because the incomparable Burak Yılmaz scores twice as they win at Lens. Hey, should we be giving Christophe Galtier more attention? Also, the guy who scored the third goal, the guy who is this season has been the finest Canadian footballer in the world. I was watching the highlights, the Uber Eats highlights on YouTube with some English dude doing the commentary, and he called him Jonathan David. How does he pronounce his own name?
So I believe it's David. I don't know why.
Oh, have you never heard him speak?
Yeah. But he doesn't say, I've never heard him saying, I'm Jonathan David, but I believe that's the way you say it.
Okay.
It's like if you were saying Alfonso David.
But in France,
Davis.
You call him Jonathan David.
Well, no, I don't know. I've never heard.
What do people in France call him?
Jonathan David.
Okay, all right. So it's like
if you said Alfonso Davies. No one would say Alfonso Davies.
Okay.
You would say Alfonso Davies everywhere. I don't know why. I don't know.
Anyway, let's get back to Lille and Gold. Is it Gaultier? Because they changed so many players. He's got old guys. He's got young guys.
Yeah, he was good.
He's got José Font.
I know, but it's the whole old centre-back with young centre-back. You know, it's the Font and Botman. It's the... those kind of partnership, the experience against the youth, with the youth, sorry, and the two blending. I think he's doing a great job, and I want to stress that it's not just this season that Galtier is doing a great job. He's done a great job at Saint-Etienne before, taking them into the top four. He's taken this Lille team into the Champions League before. So it's not just like that's one freaky season where he's an okay manager and just everything goes their way. No, he's been building this squad and at this team and at this club around for this. Yeah, it would be an incredible achievement if they win this title, and I believe they will now, and he deserves a lot of credit. And like I've said to you before, Gab, the only sadness I have is that he won't be there next season, probably, because he would go to bigger
Spurs.
Things and better things. Maybe Spurs. He would love to come to England.
Is he the best French manager in the 100%. World right now, excluding the ones who've won World Cups?
In Champions League, yeah.
Excluding, well, Zidane
won
the World Cup.
Sorry, right? I thought you meant World Cup as a manager, sorry.
Really? You're setting the bar that high?
I think that apart from Deschamps and Zidane, there's no other French manager better than Galtier right now.
Galtier is definitely a better manager than Didier Deschamps. I don't care how
many
World
Cups. Oh, my God.
I
haven't heard this. Even Christophe would not agree with you. But listen, they deserve a lot of love, and I would write very soon on the website about them, because it's a great story. Despite all the debts they have and all the money they're losing, they win this title, and it's going to be an absolute dream come true. Inter's B team destroys Sampdoria 5-1 as the club asks players to give up 2 months' wages as well to cope with the financial problems that they have. So, Gab, they won the title, but this is actually opposite of a bonus. And please, can we celebrate Claudio Ranieri and the Samp players for doing a guard of honour, which I believe had never happened before in Serie A, maybe?
It's not really part of our custom. They gave him the guard of honour.
But I think it was great. And it looked emotional to me.
And letting them score, letting Inter's reserve score five goals.
I know,
goals.
But I felt emotional. So I was like, okay, this is good.
Claudio Ranieri knows, like, I've written books about him, the guy very well. He knows how to play the crowd. He knows what's up. He's run his race. I'm in two minds about this because, I'm sorry, I believe in a free market. If you overspend, you will pay the price down the road. It's not Conte's fault, although he certainly didn't help matters, some of his spending, but it's right that you have to pay the price. So now these players, especially including many of these dudes who played now, they're faced a situation where the club goes to them and says, hey, listen, if you want to stay, you got to take a pay cut. If not, we'll try to sell you. We probably won't be able to sell you because we stupidly paid you much more than you're worth and nobody will take you, but can you help us? You know, I'm sorry, this is what happened. There's been a pandemic, right? We all got a deal. We all got to tighten our belts. I don't think they're going to reach a collective deal on this front. Yeah. So they're looking at different solutions. Like I said, it would be a real shame if they had to try to sell one of their big guns this summer. But the situation is so uncertain right now with the ownership, with the involvement of the Chinese government, with the involvement of some private equity funds. It's a tough way out. And, you know, for Inter, this comes
It's a shame
the
because they've just won the title. They should celebrate. And yet they're thinking more about money issues and problems and things like that.
But you know, this is the story of Inter, right?
Yeah.
So they win the Champions League, and the night that they win the Champions League, their manager leaves the stadium in a car with Florentino Perez of a different team, right? And then everything falls apart. You know, the championship they won before that, they said, well, the first one they won after a long time before that under Roberto Mancini. Oh no, this doesn't count because Juventus aren't there. I mean, the point that, like, it's the history of Inter. Hopefully, Conte is going to write a different history. Yves Bissouma has reportedly told Brighton he's ready to move on and is being tracked by Liverpool as a replacement for Gini Wijnaldum, who's out of contract. Good choice, Jules?
Very good choice, Gav. I broke that story weeks ago on the website.
Sorry, I'm only getting into it now.
It's okay, it's okay. I'm
How
a big
is he
fan
a replacement
of
for Wijnaldum, though? Isn't Bissouma much more of a... I know he works hard, but is he much more of a defensive midfielder?
No, I think he's got box-to-box in him 100%. And so
really?
The running, the intensity, the pressing...
Wijnaldum a bit more quality,
pressure,
perhaps?
Maybe on the ball, although I think Bissouma's technical ability is a bit underappreciated. I really do. I mean, I know him so well because he obviously played in France before. And I know people who are really close to him as well. And I just think he would be great. He's a great team player, great kid. And I think Klopp could make him into such a good player that, you know, I think he would be great for Liverpool. But there's not only Liverpool, I think other top.
Do you see him more as a Wijnaldum or more as a Fabinho?
No, more as a Wijnaldum. I think if you keep him as a holding midfielder, he can play there. But you're restricting him a little bit more than you need to. Atalanta destroy Parma 5-2 to remain second in the table. Gab, are we too accustomed to their brilliance to properly celebrate them?
Look, you know my feelings on Gasperini, but yeah, the short answer is yes, we are. They're the top scorers in Serie A. They've done it again with a tiny budget. They're second in the table. And let's not forget, this is an Atalanta team that at the start of the season, two of their main men were still Iličić and Papu Gomez. Yeah. And then you saw what happened. They overcame Papu Gomez. They had a great run in the Champions League. I think they'll still complain about that red card against Real Madrid. They'll feel that, you know, all of history could have turned out differently if they hadn't awarded that. It's incredible what they're doing. And they represent the truth that if you're careful with your wages, if you're smart about the way you hire, you can punch way beyond your weight. So I don't want to hear the big clubs crying, we need more money, I need more backing, give me seven strikers.
Same with
whatever.
Lille. It's the same with Lille.
Absolutely, absolutely. And these are the teams that I think that we really should be celebrating.
Yeah.
Chelsea win the Women's Super League. Jules, you follow this more than I do, but I guess it's about Emma Hayes, Frank Kirby, you know, well-oiled machine.
Completely. It's right. They've been fantastic. Emma Hayes is a wonderful manager, and I would really hope that someone in the Premier League, a club in the Premier League, would think about her. The Championship, I don't know if she would go, if she thinks that it's really a step up or not compared to this Chelsea women's team, but certainly in the Premier League, and give her a chance because I think she deserves it. She's fantastic. So is Frank Kirby. Especially when you consider the last few years that she had, and Sam Kerr up front as well, the Kirby, see what I did? Kirby partnership. Well done to them. Now they've got to go and win the Champions League next weekend because it's a big game against Barca for them. But if they could do the league and the Champions League double, that would be a very, very special season for a very special team.
And the Chelsea men's team, of course, in the Champions League final as well. I know she's spoken out about this, about possibly managing men one day. We've seen it happen before here and there. Do you think the Premier League is ready for this kind of thing, or do you think there's anybody in Premier League who would seriously consider, or do you think they would look at it and say, we've got the biggest budgets, you know, we've got the best managers, we can't take a gamble on this, but if she proves herself in another country, or do you think that they would see it as a step down? Or
I don't want to name of men's manager right now in the Premier League, but I'm pretty sure she would do better jobs than some of them, 100%.
You think?
and I know we had Corinne Diacre in France who went into the Ligue 2, the French second division, and did a really good job with Clermont, almost taking them close to going up. And I would love someone to give Emma Hayes a chance, not in Ligue 1 or Ligue 2 like we had this season, and she was quite upset that people thought that she could move from the Chelsea women, the best team in Europe that she built and that she's managing, to a team in the third or fourth division in the men's divisions. But I think maybe the Championship, she would find that a step up, but certainly the Premier League.
It's a weird subject because there haven't been many examples. Carolina Morace was the first. That was, at this stage, it's like nearly 20 years ago, I think it was.
Yeah,
she was the first woman to manage a professional men's team. It didn't last long, but she didn't leave because of bad results. She left because her team was owned by Gaucci, who's got serious issues and loves sacking people. Like nowhere that anybody has tried this has it been a disaster, and nowhere that anybody has tried this did it end because it was a woman in charge. No. And I think, you know, these little things should potentially be encouraging there. Obviously, there's a different dynamic and whatever, managing bigger egos, people make a lot more money and whatever. But you know, these so far from what we've seen, this has not been, this is not what has ended these, if you want to call them, experiments or whatever.
Definitely not. I would love it. Absolutely love it. Jose Mourinho's appointment is already paying dividends for Roma, who beat Crotone. I mean, this is Crotone. They've conceded 90 goals this season.
But I think it's Mourinho.
The worst ever is 91 in like 33, 34, Casale or whatever it was or something. So, but still, you're right. It's Mourinho and Gab. He doesn't take over until the summer, where our friend Paulo Fonseca will leave. But we've already eyes ice cream flavors, murals, a row with Paulo Di Canio as well. I mean, it's already
okay. Mourinho's, so the ice cream flavor is, it's a gimmick. They do this, and usually normally do it in Naples, actually. But you know, whenever it happens, the mural. Oh look, Mourinho on a bike. Guy, well done, PR company. This is not spontaneous. These are not like the murals in Naples. I guarantee you that. The Paulo Di Canio thing is really funny because obviously I've known the guy for 25 years. I wrote a book with him. He left a very trolling message on a WhatsApp message for a friend who was a Roma fan. But nothing he said on the message is really different from what he has said on air as a pundit. Mm. It's not different from what you or I have said. I mean, maybe some more extremes, which is he's had serious conflicts at the last four clubs he's been at, not just in England, but elsewhere. You know, he said he plays anti-football. Yeah, it's. I mean, again, you don't want to. You're not going to dispute that. You want what you would call anti-football or not, but it's not exactly. You know, it's not exactly what they were doing before. Yeah. So, like, leaving aside the fact that a private WhatsApp message should never be leaked. This is not. So whoever leaked this and put this out there. So we're talking about it because it's in the public domain. But you don't go and leak this kind of information unless there's a massive public interest. And frankly, Paulo Di Canio repeating what he's. You know, in different terms, what he already says in public is not massive public interest. News, so shame on whoever did that.
Yeah.
Florian Thauvin is, did I do all right with?
Yeah, perfect.
All right, there you go. Nice. He's following in the footsteps of André-Pierre Gignac and swapping the south of France for Mexico. Jules, two things. First of all, what's the special Mexican-French connection? Secondly, when Gignac went, I know it really worked out for him. I thought, okay, dude, you're the size of a house. You can't run. You're one-footed. You've hit your ceiling in Europe.
Yeah.
I get it. You want to...
Yeah.
I'm
going with you.
But Florian Thauvin, okay. He's had ups and downs in his career. He's a talented player. He's 28 years old.
Yeah.
Is this the lifestyle choice?
I don't know.
Money?
It's not even that.
He's going to Tigres.
Yeah, he's going to Tigres, to Monterrey, to team up again with Gignac. They play together for Marseille. But it's not like if they were brothers and, you know, they were dying to play with each other again. Yeah, okay. And
given what Gignac looks like and his background, and given what Thauvin looks like, I cannot imagine the two of them hanging out together on a Saturday night.
Exactly. So it's not, but that could have
been. He doesn't have the stupid curl anymore, does he?
No, not anymore. No. But that could have been a reason of like, oh, I miss my buddy. I want to go there.
But it's not.
It's not that.
It's not like a Zach Griezmann situation.
No, could it be money? Maybe, but again, I think Tigres have offered quite a big contract with a big signing on fee. But I'm pretty sure that other European clubs could have paid and offered similar numbers. So I don't know. Is it because Gignac said it's amazing here? You're going to become a legend like Gignac has become, because Gignac, as you said, has done incredibly well. Maybe, but Thauvin doesn't have the personality and the character that Gignac has to start with.
He does seem a little lightweight.
He does a bit in a league that is is quite physical, with a lot of intensity, a lot of rhythm. So it might work out for him, and I really hope it does. But you're right; it is a strange choice in many respects to go at 28 when you won the World Cup 3 years ago with France. Okay, he hasn't been picked for 2 years now, but Deschamps. But still, you know, it's.
I love it. I think it's a great story. I love it when players do this. And I'm officially on team Thauvin now.
True, but Andy Delors went to Mexico as well. Didn't work out for him. Went back to France. Kolo Jezak went to Tigres as well. Same agent as Gignac and Delors and all of that. Didn't work out for him. Went back. So it's not because Gignac has worked out that everybody else will work out coming from France to Mexico and that it will work for Thauvin. But let's see. Patrick Vieira has been linked to the job at Lyon alongside Christophe Galtier, who we mentioned earlier, Marcelo Gallardo, the River Plate manager, and Roberto De Zerbi. I mean, I would love it, Gab, if they go to De Zerbi and he comes to Ligue 1. So I guess Patrick Vieira won't be joining Daniel Ek at Arsenal, and we were not really sure what capacity he would do that. But what about De Zerbi to Lyon?
Let me take this Daniel Ek thing first. Because remember the story comes out, there was a Vieira, Bergkamp, and Thierry Henry. Yeah. I haven't really paid attention because I don't want to spend too much time in Arsenal world and the mid-table, whatever. Did these guys actually say, oh yeah, Daniel Ek is our buddy and we're all on board with him?
Thierry said it was very vague on what kind of role they would have. He just said that that Daniel Ek reached out to them three to say that he was preparing a bid and an offer and that he kind of would want them involved somehow, somewhere.
And it's like, oh, let's talk later. But none of these people are campaigning for him.
No.
Okay, just to be, which is why Patrick Vieira is considered. I feel like Vieira has been linked to the Lyon job on and off again for many, many years.
He has, but not as much as this time. And his agent, who is a really big agent in France, has put him forward. And it seems that Lyon are quite receptive.
I'm looking at this because obviously Galtier, we spoke about him before, would make sense moving up to a bigger club, better finance club. De Zerbi would be wonderful. He left field would be really, really cool. I have no idea if he speaks French. I'm sure he could pick it up.
But he speaks a lot of languages, so he would learn quickly, I think.
Gallardo, or Gajardo, as we like to call him. Obviously, he played in France, presumably he speaks French.
Yes, he does.
He's one of those guys, though, who's been like, oh, he's ready to make the jump for Europe. We've said this every year for the last 5 years. I think he's kind of happy where he is, no?
7 years at River Plate. It's a long time. They won 2 Copa Libertadores. He's got 6 months left on his contract. So there's a point where maybe he's thinking, okay, this time...
He's not getting any younger now.
No, he's not. But I would love him in Europe. I think he's one of the ones who deserve a chance.
You think it would be an easier transition to France, I presume, than him going to Spurs or something?
Yeah, I would think so. And I think he sees it that way too.
When Manchester United won the league in 2013, Alexander Butner made 5 appearances, but I guess it meant a lot since he revealed a giant mural in his house showing him hugging Sir Alex Ferguson. Jules?
I don't even know where to start, Gab. Let's start by the mural. It's ugly. I'm sorry, Alexander Butner. It's ugly. It doesn't even look like Sir Alex.
It looks like
Gerard Houllier than Sir Alex Ferguson. I'm not even sure it looks like Butner himself. 2, you've played 2 minutes for Manchester United and yet took no part at all, almost, in winning this title, and you celebrate in your own home. I mean, how sad is this?
It's just odd, I guess.
Oh my God.
I don't know. It's weird.
What? So imagine Cristiano's murals in his house. Like, how many murals?
Why do you think Cristiano owns a chain of hotels? There's murals of him next to his silverware in every different room. That's right. He needs a big hotel.
Oh, dear. Why have we gone down to now? Sapia Berman became the first transgender referee a week ago when she took charge of a game between Beitar Jerusalem and Hapoel Haifa in Israel. Gab, how important is this?
I think this is really important. I think trans visibility is a big issue. It's a big issue for our company. We've both had a colleague who went through this. So I think it's more important. And what I find really encouraging has been the reaction. Beitar Jerusalem have some pretty extreme hardcore
fans.
And they had signs calling Superwoman. They're celebrating this. Ultimately, from a fan perspective, if you're not into trans visibility or whatever, all you care about is, can this person this person refereed in the top flight for several years and will still do it? It's simply, now they're doing it in a position which they're far more comfortable.
Completely.
I think it's important. It's to be celebrated.
Yeah.
Right. That brings us to an end, but we got a lot of football coming up. So should we come back on Thursday?
Let's do that. Yeah.
Until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.
Real quick, what's the easiest choice you can make? Window seat over middle? Taco Tuesday over salad? What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/gabjules, all lowercase. Go to Shopify.com/GabJules now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/GabJules.